And now, Stein Online presents Mark Stein on the Town.
Hey, welcome along. If you've been swinging by these parts for a few years, you'll know I've talked to Don Black many times in every available medium, print, audio, video. We did a live music special recording when Don became the first British songwriter to win an Oscar.
Born free, as free as the wind blows, as free as the grass grows, born free to follow your heart.
And a couple of years after that, Don had the Billboard number one record of the year.
Those schoolgirl days of telling tales and biting nails are gone. But in my mind, I know they
We did a big audio special on all the James Bond theme songs Don's written, as sung by Tom Jones.
So he strikes like thunderbolt.
And Shirley Bassey.
Diamonds are forever. Hold one up and then caress it. Touch it. Stroke it and undress it. I can see every part. Nothing hides in the heart to hurt me.
And Lulu.
He has a powerful weapon. He charges a million a shot. An assassin, a second to none. The man with the golden gun.
And K.D. Lang.
Tomorrow never dies. Surrender. Tomorrow will arrive. On time, I'll tease and tantalize with every line till you are mine. Tomorrow never dies.
And garbage. About his Broadway and West End shows.
I don't know why I'm frightened. I know my way around here. The cardboard trees, the painted seas, the sound here. Yes, a world to rediscover. But I'm not in any hurry.
That's Barbara Streisand singing a big hit from Don's score with Andrew Lloyd Webber and Christopher Hampton for Sunset Boulevard. Don Black's songs have been recorded by everyone from Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra to Eminem and Kanye West, unnervingly enough. Since that Oscar, he's won pretty much everything, from Tony Awards to, just recently, the Olivier Award, which was presented to him at the London Palladium by Her Royal Highness the Duchess of Cornwall. I believe there was actual human interaction taking place at that event. It wasn't just done on Zoom like everything else is done these days. But in this show, we're not going to talk about the Oscars and the Tonys and the big hit songs, but about Don himself and the songwriting life as revealed in his best-selling memoir, The Sanest Guy in the Room. I played a very small part in that, as we'll discuss, but it's a pleasure to have Don Black with us. And Don, I must say, first of all, you're not just a terrific songwriter, written musicals, films, but you are also a COVID survivor because you got clobbered by this thing. So I have to ask you, first of all, how are you feeling these days?
I've fully recovered. Mm. I say that, but I'm touching wood at the same time.
Yeah.
Because I am over it. But, you know, you read in the papers that this long COVID.
And right.
Oh, my God, what's that? So as if to say it can come back any minute. But I try not to think of that. I'm living the life exactly as I did before I got COVID. And, you know, I was in hospital for 9 days, and it wasn't as bad as people think. People expect a terrible story about this, but I was in hospital, which is terrible, but I never felt out of it. I never felt ill because I was surrounded by compassionate people. People who used to hold my hand and saying, "You're doing very well, Mr. Black." And when I went to bed, there's a lovely nurse there who stroked my hair and say, "Sweet dreams, Mr. Black." It was like being with a little family. There's a lot of talk about the NHS and how wonderful they are medically, but very little about their compassion.
Yeah, that's interesting because when you eventually left the hospital, the nurses gave you a real send-off.
Yes. Well, that was a wonderful moment because my real name is Blackstone. I never changed my name legally. So I went to hospital as Donald Blackstone. And one day the nurse said to me, "You've got very soft hands, Mr. Blackstone. What do you do, or what did you do?" I said, "Well, I'm a songwriter." And she said, "Well, what have you written?" I said, "Oh, I'm too exhausted. Just Google me. And when they took me out, when the time was come to leave, they wheeled me out and the doors opened and there were about 20 nurses and they all applauded and sang Born Free. One of the most emotional moments of my life, apart from this one.
Well, that actually is a fantastic, as you say, that's nothing to do with the medical expertise. That's human contact, which is always the best part of life.
Yeah, I felt very much at home. While I've got this interview, I do want to say one thing. I want to thank you sort of personally for giving me the title to the book.
I was going to ask you where this, it's a striking title, The Sanest Guy in the Room. That's the title of your book. Where'd that come from?
It came because of an article you wrote or a piece you wrote somewhere that said, I guarantee you that if Don Black is working on a project, he will be the sanest guy in the room. Mm. And I thought at the time, that's great. I didn't know if it was a compliment or not at the beginning. And then I thought, you know, that's pretty accurate. And so many people have said to me, what a great title for a book. Yeah. And so thank you for that.
Well, I meant it because you've worked with very extraordinary people over the years, whether it's Andrew Lloyd Webber or Michael Jackson or Barbara Streisand. And they are people who are of extraordinary talents, but who are perceived as being just a little bit overwound up with respect to things. And so you can be sitting in a room, you know, you've done this all your life. You're sitting in a room with directors, choreographers, performers at the very top of the game. And in a certain sense, they can be a little bit nutty, a little bit weird. And you don't have any of that about you. I think I said you were like the least weird person in show business.
Yes, you did. Yeah. Well, I've tried to live my life. You know, you don't plan how you are and how you live your life, but analyzing it, because you do analyze yourself when you write a memoir. And I came to the conclusion that I've led my life with two words sum it up: dedication for whatever I'm working on and detachment when I go home. And that's kept me stable and sane.
Yeah, that's a rare combination. There's a photograph in this book, Don, of you at some or other Hollywood party a few years back. And there's you and Petula Clark and Michael Jackson and Sophia Loren. And it's a slightly weird grouping because you're not entirely sure what the connection between Sophia Loren and Michael Jackson is, or even between Michael Jackson and Petula. But I may be being a little unfair here, because Petula Clark is certainly grounded. She's been doing what she does since she was 5 years old or something, which is a long time now. But my sense there in that photograph of the four of you is that you still, somewhere within you, you're still that little kid growing up in the East End of London, and you're aware of that, and you're aware that shooting the breeze with Sophia and Petula and Jacko is a slightly unusual situation, and that I don't get the sense that many people at that level in show business actually retain that kind of little bit of their past. It doesn't beat actively within them like it does with you.
Well, it isn't intentional. And as you are an expert on songs, I'll quote you a line that you will know straight away. That is one of my favorite lines in any song. Where is the real stuff in life to cling to?
Ah, yes.
Which is from Make Someone Happy by Betty Comden and Adolph Green and Julie Stein. And where is the real stuff in life to cling to? Well, it certainly isn't a Hollywood party with Sophia Loren and Michael Jackson. That's a moment.
Right.
Stuff to cling to is when you get out of there and face real life, when you get home, if you've got a happy home.
Let me ask you, though, about someone like Mike, because I always think Michael Jackson is either these days... it's been whatever it is now, a decade since he died young. And he, to some people, he's a joke, a punchline. He's Wacko Jacko wandering around in his surgical mask. And to other people, there's something darker. There's all these accusations and things that go around. But you actually, when you knew Michael Jackson, because you wrote his first solo number one, but he was just like the kid who used to come round to your home and paint with Shirley, your late wife. And so you, in a sense, you have the advantage of 99.99% of the world's population in that you knew a real Michael Jackson.
Well, I did. He was 14 when he recorded Ben. And, you know, looking back, I just have wonderful memories of talking to him about his favorite song, which was Inchworm from Hans Christian Andersen.
Inchworm, measuring the marigold, you and your arithmetic, you'll probably go far.
And I remember him singing the first few lines of it while we were playing pool, because I've always been a thing on snooker. I've had a thing for that. And pool. And he painted with Shirley. We had a lot of laughs. He swam in a swimming pool in Los Angeles. And he was delightful. He was just an innocent kid of 14. And then I met him a few times, a year or so later. He was still that innocent guy, although he started to dress very funny. you know, and these kind of, I don't know what you call them, these 76 trombones type of
outfit. That's right. He was like Sergeant Pepper or something.
Yes.
He was like,
He had fringes on his
epaulets.
Shoulder.
Yeah, epaulets, yeah.
And then we didn't see each other for a while. And he used to call me when he came to London at the most peculiar hours and say, in a very high voice, do you want to come out? And it was like midnight. And he wanted me to show him Big Ben and things like that. I could see the rot setting in. No, we only have good memories of that. It's just that his father one day called me and said, if you want to keep in touch with Michael, you've got to go through me. Yeah. And that put me off a lot. So his father was quite, he was an awful looking man. He looked like something out of The Godfather.
And do you actually, when you, because that's a lovely record that Michael Jackson made of Ben. And it wasn't like when he became in the Thriller and the whatever it was, Big period, where he was, in a sense, he wound up with the number one best-selling album of all time or whatever it is. And the sense that you can never go back and just like make a nice little record of Inchworm, if he'd ever had the inclination to do that.
Been the two of us need look no more. We both found what we were looking for. With the friend to call my own, I'll never be alone. And you, my friend, will see you got a friend in me.
Something about Ben that isn't quite there when you get to the stuff he was doing at the end.
No, I mean, he said in his autobiography that his favourite lines that he's ever sung are, I used to say, I and me, now it's us, now it's we.
Yeah.
He got very teary when he sang that.
I used to say,
another memory which is so vivid and it sounds so ludicrous, but he was so fascinated by Matt Monro, because I had a big connection with Matt Monro. I wrote his songs and I managed him for a long time. And he couldn't believe that Matt Monro was a bus driver. And he sang like that. And it was an odd thing, but we did speak a long time about that. He just couldn't get over a bus driver being able to sing like that. You know, he was very childlike and, it was lovely.
Now I used to say I and me, now it's us, now it's we. They're all monosyllables. There's no fancy words like epaulettes in there. That's as basic an example of the great thrust of your book. which is a book that's actually like a collection of songs, in that every episode is short and compressed and says what it needs to say and then moves on. And that's what your comedy was like, that's what your songwriting is like, and that's what your book is like. You like to have a short space and to be able to say it in on a few notes or a few words.
Yeah, I mean, I've never written a book before. As you know, because I lost my wife, Shirley, and people said, work, work, work. That's the best way to deal with grief. And Shirley read the first couple of pages and laughed. She thought it was a funny approach to a book. Huh. And so I thought, okay, I'll carry on with it, really just to keep busy. And I was influenced by a couple of people, you in particular. I'm always influenced by you, Mark. I am. I am. And when you said, if you're going to write a memoir, you've got to find your own voice.
Right.
That's what you said to me, and that stayed with me. I then read this quote of Thornton Wilder, which he says, if you write to impress, it will be no good. It will be bad. If you write to express, it will be good. Hmm. And I thought, that's good, that's true. Try and be yourself, what with your wisdom and his wisdom. And then I spoke to people who've written books, and they just said, just be yourself and right. just get it down. Worry about yeah. it later. And so I wrote it just really in one breath, not trying to write it. You know, I didn't want it to feel like a writer, like I've written a book.
Right.
I just wanted to be me. Because you said that, you've got to find your own voice. So I said it in my own voice. And, you know, it's been very successful. And no one is more surprised by me. A completely unexpected success this has been.
Well, it's full of great insights. And the interesting part, which is often true, I think, in it, when people do autobiographies or memoirs, is you always want to know where somebody came from. And you came from the East End of London, and you were basically a fan. You liked going to movies and seeing all the big stars, and you liked listening to the songs and the singers. And then you basically got your first break as a teenager at the New Musical Express, which was a big deal in those days in Britain, in the music business.
Well, yes. And of course, that was in Denmark Street, known as Timpan Alley. Mm. And I was surrounded by songwriters and music publishers. But, you know, songwriters are very special people. They never seem to lose their twinkle. And so there were a lot of old men there that were very childlike, people like Tommy Connor, who wrote Lily Marlene and I Saw Mummy Kissing Santa Claus.
Right.
And, you know, I could go on with lots of names, but, you know, the people who wrote South of the Border. And
yeah,
all these
Jimmy Kennedy. Yeah.
Yeah, and Michael Carr.
Yeah.
And I remember Michael Carr saying to me, I've got to find an idea for a song. I'm going to go to the park. And I thought, what a way to make a living. He never told me which park he went to. But, And I just thought, and I've always loved words, and I've always loved those early songs. I remember saying to my sisters, those lines, fish gotta swim, birds gotta fly, I gotta love one man till I die. It's so clever because it's saying I love you without saying the overused phrase.
Fish gotta swim, birds gotta fly, I gotta love one man till I die.
And they used to look at me and say, is Donald all right? You know, those things registered with me. I just, you know, every time we say goodbye, I remember early on, I know it's a great song, but that line, why the gods above me who must be in the know? I thought, oh, it's
right.
Fantastic. It's different, it's fresh.
Why the gods above me?
Then I met Matt Monro, and he was looking for songs, and I was very friendly with him and John Barry. We were like the Three Musketeers at that time. And then, as you know, Matt Monro found this tune, like Warum nur warum, an Austrian tune by Udo Jürgens. And Matt said, "Listen, son," "if Lionel Bart can do it, why can't you?" And so I wrote this song called Walk Away.
Walk away, please go, before you throw your life away. A life that I could share for just a day. We should have met some years ago. For your sake I say, walk away, just go.
And it was very successful. It was a top five record. And it was one of John Barry's favorite songs. And he said to me one day, "Do you fancy having a go at Thunderball?" Which is what he was working on.
He knows the meaning of success. His needs are more, so he gives less. They call him the winner who takes all. And he strikes like thunderbolt.
And so I'm cutting this short. There were a lot of bad B-sides that came along, but they were the two major things. Walk Away, then Thunderball. They were great moments.
Well, let me ask you, though, because you're the generation that should have been into rock and roll. That, in other words, at the time you were getting your foothold in the music business. You mentioned Lionel Bart. He was writing these rock and roll songs for Cliff Richard, and there was Tommy Steele, and that's aside from all the American fellas like Elvis and Bill Haley, and with the exception of a theme tune you did for a television series in the 90s, I'm not actually sure you've ever gotten into the rock and roll thing. Was that something that just didn't mean anything to you?
No. The things that my heroes round about that time were a man called Oscar Brown Jr., who I love, Oscar Brown Jr., and Jake Thackeray. Someone once called Jake Thackeray the Northern Noel Coward.
Now we're agreed that we're in love, we'll have to face the la di da. The eyewash, all of the fancy pantomime, I love you very much. I'll try love, I'll bill and coo with your gruesome Auntie Susan. I'll stay calm, I'll play it cool. I'll let your tetchy uncles get me back up close my heart. And I shan't get shirty when they say I look peculiar.
If you dissect his work, it's absolutely brilliant. Oscar Brown Jr. is the most underrated guy ever, I think, because I saw him live many times. Yeah. And he wrote Waking Up Big Rocks on a Chain Gang, and I'm sure you know more about him.
On her way to work one morning down the path alongside the lake, a tender-hearted woman saw a poor half-frozen snake. His pretty colored skin had been all frosted with the dew. Poor thing, she cried, I'll take you in and I'll take care of you. Take me in, tender woman, take me in for heaven's sake. Take me in, tender woman, sighed the snake.
They were my kind of heroes, Alan Sherman, people who had a different way with words. I was never into Elvis. I mean, I didn't dislike him, But, you know, I was much more, if Alan King was appearing, comedy, as I've said before, comedy was in my blood. It's a shame it wasn't in my act. but it has always been in my blood. And I tried it for a couple of years to be a comedian. And there is a correlation between being a comedian and being a songwriter, a lyric writer, because they don't waste a syllable either.
Yeah, no, you always make it sound as if you were a terrible comedian. And when you tell that you, whatever your line is, you said you wrote your first song while waiting for a laugh in
Darlington
or wherever it was. And I was looking at, there's a picture in the book of a poster. I think you're at the Hippodrome in Birmingham, perhaps. And there's a huge, all these people on the bill, all these acts that are completely forgotten. And there's Don Black. And you look so, in those days, you look so young. And you say you were basically telling the jokes of middle-aged American male comedians. And people didn't want to hear it from a young kid.
Well, I was stealing their material. Mm. And I did look very young, and I was doing mother-in-law jokes. It just wasn't believable. Oh. So it was a ludicrous time. But apart from that, to be a comedian is, they are the, and I was watching the other day, Dave Chappelle, who I know is enormous in America. And he talks about comedians as being the greatest. He's elevated stand-up comedy. These are the real heroes of today and the pioneers of everything. And there's something in that, you know, if it's a great stand-up comedian, that they give more than you think.
Well, you use the word detachment, and it does, I think comedy requires a little bit of detachment because you're in a situation, but there's a side of you that sees the absurdity of the situation. And you're a funny guy, which is why people always want to book you to be the compere and the MC of any of awards nights or the Vivian Ellis Prize that you did for many years in London. But you just have a funny way. I mean, everyone, I think before I'd even met you, Lulu had said to me when the phone rang, and she always goes, "Wait, this could change everything." And then she rather theatrically picked up the phone, and she said afterwards, "That's like a line of yours that she always used." And I remember years and years ago, we were on one of those terrible BBC light entertainment shows that they used to have, and I think it was being recorded in Brighton with an audience in a theatre there. And it was like a quiz, musicals quiz show. And they said, the question was, I was comparing, and I said, "Don, we're going to play you this famous song from Oliver, and you have to identify each of the 10 different singers who are singing this song." And it was Lionel Bart's Lovely Ballad from Oliver, "As Long As He Needs Me." And if you're going to play 10 different singers, you just want two bars of each, and then you name them. And instead, the producer had, it was the world's longest montage. And you could feel the audience desperate to flee the theater as they were listening to it. And at the end of it, when it finally ended, you said, "That's longer than I've ever needed anyone." And that's just like a... That's like a funny line, just to put a button on the world's longest and most interminable montage of "As Long As He Needs Me." And you just said very deadpan at the end, "That's longer than I've ever needed anyone." Do people either have that or do people either look at things that way or they don't?
I always remember, I know you like a bit of name dropping, but I once was at a dinner with Peter Ustinov, who made a... It was an Oscar dinner in England for all the Oscar winners. Mm. And it was quite a ritzy affair. And Peter had to make this speech, which was brilliant, as that's what he did. And afterwards, I said, no notes. And he was just fabulous. And I said, what a wonderful thing you can do. He said, let me give you a bit of advice. Whenever you have to do anything, keep a loose hand on the handlebar. Don't be verbatim. Always be loose about everything. Yeah. And I try to, like this interview with you, you know, I haven't prepared anything. And I don't try not to think about it too much, because I think spontaneity is better. And it's also very attractive if you get one right every now and again.
Well, the interesting thing in the book, you mention your sons who are also in the music business. But the funny, they seem to have inherited your sense of humor. There's a there's two bits. This one made me laugh out loud when I read it, because there, you have that situation that can be a bit awkward in the age of Google, where there's another person of some prominence with your name, and you have a little note on him called the other Don Black. And he's basically a white supremacist on the internet. And he's a Ku Klux Klan man and all the rest of it. So you have that thing where occasionally in your Google news feed, you'll wake up one morning and there'll be a bit about someone recording Diamonds Are Forever and a bit about a new musical, and then suddenly there'll be something about the hate monger Don Black and calls for him to be banned or whatever. And your son actually came up with a brilliant line on that, and it made me laugh out loud when I read it in the book.
Well, it was Grant who said to me, I wonder if he gets inquiries for Tell Me on a Sunday.
And which is actually a funny thought, that there's a Ku Klux Klansman who has the opposite problem of you. He wakes up every morning and there's things in his Google news feed, yeah, about someone doing a new cover version of To Sell With Love or whatever.
Yes, that's right.
It's like a weird, because it's like the collision of two completely separate worlds, and it's a funny thing. The other thing that your kids have, which I thought was just a great line that they use, like whenever your son comes and tells you that he's been told he's getting the new Mariah Carey single or whatever. And there's a great line that you three all share on those kinds of things.
Yes. When will it be off?
Right, right.
We always do that. You know, whenever I say I think I've got the
Yeah,
next,
when will it fall through? Yeah.
When will it fall through?
Yeah.
And we do that all the time. All the time. But Clive, my other son who's in the record business and publishing, he says he's been offered a job in New York to run a record company. It won't be off for at least 2 or 3 weeks.
No.
I just say we can really enjoy the next few weeks until it's falling through. It keeps you grounded, that kind of attitude.
Yeah, but it's also actually very true about the kind of life you lead, because people think when you have a bit of success, so, okay, it's great, you have a number one record, and then somebody offers you a big movie theme, and then you do a Broadway show and all the rest of it. But actually, when you look at the amounts of time that a career is taken up with, there's all these things where you're having lunch with someone and they're pitching you like a fabulous new show and you're going to have the best director and it's got the biggest star and it's all just like chuntering along and then somehow it never happens. And that's actually like 90% of what it is, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, George Kaufman, you know, the writer who, you know, in his book, it's Act One. In Act One, he says, for anyone working in the theatre, disappointment is inevitable. Mm. And I think that's very true as well. You know, there's so much failure around. Alan J. Lerner, who wrote Everything, and then he had 6 flops in a row, and then Oscar Hammerstein the same. But you have to be able to roll with the punches. It's as simple as that. And if you can't do that, then you're in the wrong game.
And Alan was the first of the, because Alan wrote My Fair Lady and Gigi and Camelot and Brigadoon and on and on. And he was the first of those great American writers to say to me what a great lyricist you were, and he loved Tell Me on a Sunday because he thought that was a lyricist's show. Don't say that to Andrew, obviously, but he thought that was a lyricist's show. I mean, there's nothing, that it's the words, and the words are sung, and the words that are sung carry the show.
Hello, Mr. Stigwood's office. No, I'm afraid he's at a screening. If you would like to leave word, we'll get right back to you. Thank you for calling. Have a nice day.
Cat teeth and Caesar salad. Rhyme time, Beverly Hills. The cost of land so high you can't afford to die. When you feel bad there, you dial a prayer. Earthquakes and English muffins, ulcers popping away. It's like a fairy tale, long as you don't inhale. I'll call you back. I'll call you back and have a nice day.
It was odd to me at that time because I was like talking to him about Ira Gershwin and Oscar Hammerstein, blah, blah, blah. And he suddenly brings up Don Black. And it seemed odd to hear somebody from that golden Broadway generation suddenly mention this English guy and have huge extravagant praise for him in the same breath that he's talking about Larry Hart and Irving Berlin and all. When did you know that those kind of people thought you were top notch and top draw?
Well, I mean, I'm so thrilled to be in the same arena, to be in the same sentence as those people. But when I wrote the musical Billy, which was on in London for 3 years at Drury Lane, I wrote with John Barry, people started to say the lyrics are really, really great. You know, I remember Anthony Newley wrote to me. He sent me a cable at the time. He said, "You're going to make a lot of new friends." And it was lovely. I didn't realize I was any good at it, but I thought, yeah, I mean, when I look at it now, Billy was very good. You know, some of us belong to the stars.
Right.
I mean, I was so young at the time, but there was something to sing about. It's a great story, Billy Liar. And then I think I've always had fire in my belly for great lyric writers. And so you can't see them, but I've got every book on every, you know, from Frank Lesser to everybody. And I think if you devote so much of your time and if you really enjoy it as much as I do, because I know you're the same. When I hear a great song, I get so much pleasure from it. And that's easy to say, but more pleasure than it sounds. I mean, I could listen to a great song by Rodgers and Hart, and I've got to play it three times. I just can't believe it. You know, it's just so wonderful. You know, the gracefulness, the solutions, how they get to it, how they solve it.
Yeah.
I know you know, because you know more about songwriting than anyone else in the world. So I know, you know, but I'm thinking of your listeners now.
No, I wonder though, what's the difference? Because you say there's a sort of constant refrain every few chapters in the book. You say when this subject comes up, you say, "I don't want to sound like an old curmudgeon. I don't want to sound like a cranky old guy." But what's the difference between Rodgers and Hart and the stuff that your sons are involved with today in today's songs, and some of the people you know and work with today? What's the difference between what we think of as the great standards and whatever's at number seven on the hit parade today?
Well, it's hard to say in a word, but if I had to choose one word, it would be craftsmanship, because everything by Rodgers and Hart, it was so honed and polished and insightful. The lyrics I'm talking about. And today's music, although there is some terrific people around, obviously every generation has some good people, but you know, you could rhyme hotel with lemonade and no one would quibble about it.
No.
Whereas in all these books I have on my shelf, there isn't one impure rhyme in an Irving Berlin song or a Cole Porter song. And I miss that craft. And even now, when you go and see musicals now, that craft is lost, a lot of it is.
Before
it used to be just pop music. You think, oh, well, it's pop music. Every generation has whatever. But it does annoy me when I go to the theatre and hear lazy lyric writing.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's only, you know, the two of us, I think, would hear them.
Well, it's not quite the two. What I find interesting is a few years ago, you and Van Morrison got together and started writing songs, and you've had, until the COVID came along, you and he just used to have lunch in London, and he's recorded a lot of standards. He roughs them up a little, which I quite like. So he makes them sound, sound, a little less polished, to go back to what you were saying, as if they're more sort of raw and vernacular. But he loves this stuff, and you and he sit and have lunch, and Van Morrison is talking to you about people like Carl Sigman, who wrote the lyrics to It's All in the Game. And there's a side of the rockers that like wants a piece of that world, don't you think?
And of course, I'm not the ideal person for Van Morrison, although we've written, I think, a dozen songs together. Mm. And I changed my way, you know, because as a lyric writer, you have to be flexible. Mm. And I listened to a bit of Van Morrison. I didn't know much about him apart from his hits. And I gave him three or four lyrics I thought he might like. And I didn't rhyme everything as I would normally. I just left them loose and just see if he liked it. And then I never heard from him at all. And I said, didn't you like them? He said, I've recorded all of them. So,
one thing I've learned after all these years, you're gonna save yourself a whole lot of tears. Don't try to figure out who was wrong and who was right. Got to move along, baby. Yeah, you got to go with the flow. Roll with the punches. Yeah, that's one thing I know. No use staring at your old photographs. Walking around your neighborhood, gotta tear it in half. Only one way you can clear your tormented mind. Stop thinking she was one of a kind. You got to roll with the punches. Man, you got to go with the flow. Tear it in half. Only one way you can clear your tormented mind. Stop thinking she was just one of a kind. You got the roll with the puncher. Man, you got to try and go with the flow.
Takes what I've given him, he might add a few lines, and I don't mind that at all because it's got his stamp on it. You know, if you look at, I'm a huge fan of Tom Waits, so my kids idolize Tom Waits. Now, you don't need rhymes from Tom Waits, but you've got to remember those people like Van Morrison and Tom Waits, they write for themselves. No one covers their songs. I remember when Tom Waits sang Somewhere, I think, Somewhere from West Side Story. It made so much news because he never did anything like that before. But no, I think, Bruce Springsteen, all these people, Bob Dylan, they write for themselves. No one covers them. So it's different to me. I'm not a performer. So when I write, I have to think, who can I get it to?
Right.
And who's looking for a song, you know, that kind of thing. But yeah, you know, I still think it's just as hard writing a song for Taylor Swift as it is for writing a Broadway show. It's a different skill, and I prefer writing for a Broadway show. But it's just another side to it.
You said something to me years ago. I think that Alan J. Lerner had said to you that it's good to have a regular composing partner, because a composer and a lyricist grow together. And I think the example Alan used to give was Kander and Ebb, who were like the last team on Broadway. They wrote Cabaret and Chicago, and between those things, they wrote a lot of stuff that wasn't as good. And I never thought of you as someone who had a regular partner in that sense. But you write about John Barry in your book. And I don't think I'd realized quite how much you'd written with him. You were very close friends, and he was the closest you had to a regular songwriting partner. And I think by the end, you'd been writing together for over 40 years, something like that. And he was special. He was special to you, and you were special to him. You describe yourself as his only real friend.
That is true, and it sounds an odd thing to say, but his wife, Laurie, his widow, says exactly the same. He did. There's a lot of people he didn't like, and he was happy to tell them. It wasn't that he was argumentative, but he just couldn't bear to do business with them. Or we just got on well together. He was a loner, and he didn't want to spend time with what he called phony people. He used to use the word artificial.
Right.
Artificial. And I got on very well with him because it was quite easy to write with him. He gave me melodies, and I know that he really went through the mill to get the right tune. And when he gave it to me, when he gave me the tune, I it was like an unveiling, because I know he'd been through all the agony of it. And I know that, you know, I knew the kind of lyrics he liked. He liked, you know, uncomplicated, touching, if he could make it a bit moving, and universal thoughts. And it was a joy. It was just a joy. It's Yeah, I miss him. And I do agree that if you can work with the same collaborator all your life, you do find each other's strengths and weaknesses. Having said that, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed working with Quincy Jones and Henry Mancini and Brian May, any sort of...
Yeah.
It's fun. It sounds a bit promiscuous, if you like, but it's very enjoyable to see how someone else... I mean, Andrew, as I say in my book, they're all very different people, these people that I mentioned, but they're all the same at the piano. I was going to call my book, How Does It Go? Because that's all I need to know, really. I don't have to meet them. And I, as you know, I like to play snooker. And, you know, it's like, or pool, as you call it over there. And there's something that attracts me about that game. You don't have to know the person. You can just nod when you start the game. Mm. You don't have to know his name even. And it's something nice about getting a tune, doing it, sending it off. And that's it. You know, you don't have to get involved with their lives if you don't want to. And so obviously Andrew Lloyd Webber is a million miles, you know, from, you know, whoever I could think of, to Mark London, if you like. But he's still at that piano. He's looking for that modulation that's right. Because I'm not a musician. You know, I say in my book, you know, when I met Noel Gallagher recently, you know, when I met him, he said, how did you write Diamonds Are Forever? So I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, what desk have you got? I said, I haven't got a desk. He said, well, what are you, guitar, piano, what? I said, no. I said, John Barry just sent me that, la, 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 la. He sent it, and I put words to it. I can't say it here, but he said, no effing way. And so he couldn't believe it. And then I said, how do you do it? How do you work? He said, well, I've got this great desk. And he explained what it was, a three-module Dolby this and Dolby that. And I get that track right. I spend a lot of time on the track. And then I think the last thing is I better find some words to it. And so I just put some words to it. I felt like saying, no effing way. Because it's so different. He couldn't believe that I would get a tune and put words to it. And I try to explain to him that that's how they all worked.
Yeah.
All of them. And he still couldn't believe it, that you could just pick up and write a lyric like that.
No, but it's a weird. You have another thing in the book, which while we're talking about your cred with the Rockers, because you actually wound up having one of your songs recorded by Morrissey and the Smiths. That one of those things that just kind of happens. So that was another old movie song.
Yeah, that was called "Work Is a Four-Letter Word." It starred what's his name, David somebody other, who was a very famous actor, and it was the weirdest film I've ever seen in my life. Peter Hall directed it, and Cilla Black sang the title song.
If you'll cry, I'll be right behind you, and my love will help to remind you to forget that work is a four-letter word. I don't want a house that's a show place. I just feel that we're getting no place while you say that work is a four-letter word. Don't waste your life. There is so much I know you can do. Let me see you.
I couldn't believe it. The Smiths recorded it after.
Loving you is driving me crazy. People say that you were born lazy, cause you say that work is a four-letter word. So change your life. There is so much I know. You can do. Come and see me.
The thing about what I like about that the business with Morrissey, who loved Work is a Four Letter Word. That was just one of those songs he loved. And I ran into one of the Smiths like years later. And my understanding is that that's actually the song, they regard that as the song that broke up the Smiths, because one of the other Smiths said to Morrissey, I didn't join the Smiths to be a Cilla Black cover band. And he was like furious that that Morrissey had wanted to do that song.
It's lovely when that happens. It's like when Kanye West sampled Diamonds Are Forever. Diamonds from Sierra Leone, he called it.
Diamonds are forever. They won't leave in the night. I've no fear that they might desert me. Diamonds are forever.
Throw your diamonds in the sky if you feel the vibe. The rock is still alive every time I rhyme. Forever, ever, forever, ever, 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 ever. Close your eyes and imagine, feel the magic. Vegas on acid, seen through East Saint Laurent glasses, and I've realized that I've arrived.
Yeah, I'd take Shirley Bassey over whatever Kanye thought he was doing with that song, though, wouldn't you?
I would, definitely, absolutely, yes.
It's a very strange business, isn't it? Because people can love songs, and yet the same song can leave other people cold. And again, to go back to the sanest guy in the room thing, in the end, people start throwing things around. The very first musical you wrote with Lionel Chetwynd, who is a Canadian screenwriter and very well known in Hollywood. Yet when he was writing a musical with you, there comes a point when he actually smashes a chair because he's so enraged at how it's going in rehearsals. I mean, it does seem to be one of these things that just winds people up, the collaborative process. At some point, there's chair smashing. You talk about the orchestrator just tossing the scores up in the air and walking out.
That's why I love Oscar Levant's quote about his definition of a musical, which I know you know, where he calls it a series of catastrophes followed by a party.
Yeah.
That is pretty accurate. There's a lot of emotional collisions in a musical. Huh. It's a very tense thing. And I don't think you could, every musical has tension. I can't believe it's just a series of just happy lunches and dinners and things. Huh. No, it's tough to get them right. I once compared it with doing your own root canal work.
What's the opposite of doing your own root canal? Maybe this, Don and Quincy Jones's lovely shimmering song for the film The Italian Job.
Questi giorni quando vieni il bel sole. La 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 la. On days like these, when skies are blue and fields are green, I look around and think about what might have been. And then I hear sweet music float around my head as I recall the many things we left unsaid. It's on days like these that I mine. On days like these, I wonder what became of you. Maybe today you're singing songs with someone new. I'd like to think you're walking by those willow trees, remembering the love we knew on days like these. It's on days like these that I remember singing songs and drinking wine while your eyes play games with mine. On days like these, I wonder what became of you. Maybe today you're singing songs with someone new. Questi giorni quando vieni il bel sole, la 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 la.
The matchless Matt Monro, as Don always says on the BBC. In part two of this special, we'll ask Don about the antidote to chair smashing and orchestral part hurling. More songs and conversation from Don Black, the sanest guy in the room, coming up in part two.
Mark Stein on the Town is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.